We can roll it whenever you're ready. Are we ready? I guess so. This is a session entitled, I got to make sure I remember it right, What the Palestinians Want and How They Hope to Get It. That's a lot to talk about in the next 15 minutes, but we'll make a stab at it. Again, if along the way I use any terminology that you are not familiar with or that you want something explained, please interrupt me and we can take questions or comments at any time. I hope we'll make it through all of this. If not, maybe we'll just go on to another session with it, because I think it's rather important. What I'm will try to do is give you, as far as I know and from the information that I have, an assessment of the situation as it exists now. If there are any people who might need some extra help with hearing or amplification, we have these little machines up here which you are free to take. What is it that the Palestinians want? Very briefly, they want their rights. They want self-determination. They want to be able to take control of their lives politically, socially. They want to have the kind of life that comes to people who have a passport, who have a constitution, who have a right to vote, etc. Things that have been certainly denied to them for many years. And this denial goes back far beyond the Israeli occupation. I think it was best articulated to me about 2 years ago when I was gathering information or talking to people, doing interviews for this book, Unified in Hope. I talked one day with a young Palestinian journalist by the name of Daoud Kutab, who is a Christian, and he lives in Jerusalem. And I asked him at that point about his dreams. I asked him what his dreams were, and he replied this way: "I don't have specific dreams. I have general dreams. I dream of being able to drive to Nazareth and continue on to Beirut. I would like to go and see my uncle's family in Amman without it being an historical experience that I wait months to prepare for." He's talking here about crossing the border to go into Jordan, which is a very difficult thing for Palestinians. "I would like to get up in the morning and participate, maybe only in a small way, in the decisions that our leaders are making. It would be nice, when I complain about the holes in my street, to have the person at the municipality speak to me on the phone in Arabic, not Hebrew. I would like to go myself to the city hall and find out who is responsible for the holes in the streets and that the lights aren't working. I want to be involved, and I want to know that we have a choice, that we have a role in our future. The Israelis make choices. I would like to be able to vote in elections every now and then. I would like to be involved in criticizing the new Palestinian state if it was not doing enough about women's rights or when the workers were being unfairly treated and so on. I don't want to spend the rest of my life complaining about the Israelis. That is not my future. I want to be involved in building my own future rather than trying to destroy Israel's future in the hope that somehow that will help me build mine. After all, this destruction, we would have to begin all over again, and I don't want to begin all over again. I just don't want to be involved in any destruction. I would be happy if the Israelis would withdraw peacefully, but unfortunately I see this happening only if they are pressured to do so. If there is another war, then directly or indirectly, I'm involved in this cycle of destruction, and I don't want this to happen. I want to be involved in building rather than destroying." The idea of self-determination in terms of how the Palestinians have described it has really changed over the years. Certainly after 1948, Palestinians talked of destroying the state of Israel, of pushing the Jews into the sea. And of course, there still are people who talk like that today. Extremists still exist on both sides of the issue. But the whole idea of self-determination has really changed. It changed from this kind of total rejectionist view of getting rid of the Israelis to a point of view which said, all right, the Israelis are here. Let's get together and have what could be called a secular democratic state, meaning we'll live here together. There'll be a Jewish minority, but we'll live together in a way that their rights as a minority will be honored by us. And of course, the Israelis said, hey, that's the whole reason we came here in the first place. We have suffered as a minority in this kind of a situation, this kind of a setup. We came here for a Jewish state because we only felt that if the state was Jewish and we were part of a Jewish majority, that our rights could be guaranteed. So the Palestinians, this Palestinian idea of a secular democratic state never really flew with the Israelis. Again, it was the Palestinian, I think, inability to grasp reality, that they could not yet understand or empathize enough with Jewish history and the Holocaust to realize that this idea was just a non-starter. That view was really replaced as time went by with a more pragmatic outlook. But before we talk about that, I think it might be nice to talk a little bit about the PLO, which of course is, as the Palestinians have said since the Rabat Conference in 1974, that they have said the Palestine Liberation Organization is their sole and legitimate representative. We should talk a little bit about the PLO, and we should talk a little bit about Yasser Arafat. The PLO became an organization in 1964. It was composed of a number of Palestinian exiles who came together in Jerusalem and decided to form a political and paramilitary organization that they thought, as the title says, would liberate Palestine. Yasser Arafat, who is the chairman of the PLO, was born in 1928. They're not sure if it's exactly 1928, but anyway, he was born near that year. Some say he was born in Jerusalem. Some say he was born in Gaza. Some say he was born in Cairo. One thing that is known is that he was brought up in Gaza, and one would believe that he, in fact, was born in Jerusalem because of his family. Arafat comes from quite a distinguished family. He looks like somebody who just came out of the desert, somebody who doesn't shave, who wears desert fatigues. But the fact is he has quite an impressive background in terms of Arab families. On his mother's side is the famous Husseini family of Jerusalem. To this day, the Husseinis are probably one of the three or four most well-known and respected families in Jerusalem, and his father was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, gives some possible ties to Egypt, but also gives you the idea that he was brought up in a situation which was rather nationalistic in his outlook. Arafat is most closely associated with one faction of the Palestine Liberation Organization. The PLO is made up of a number of different organizations, one of which is Fatah. Fatah began by a group of Palestinian students in Kuwait in about 1958 or 59. Arafat may not have been the leader at that point, but he certainly became the leader, and he was probably in the beginning some kind of an official spokesperson. When the PLO was formed, again, in 1964, Fatah came into that organization as the largest faction and probably the most moderate faction. A lot of people maybe because of certain propaganda, have tended to think of Arafat as maybe a comic and a buffoon. Certainly some of his photographs have tended to give that impression. I want you to know that this is not a... I'm not saying this as a kind of, you know, fan club for Arafat. Everybody who's been involved in this situation has bloody hands, and Arafat certainly is one of them as well. But I think it's interesting to know a little bit about his background, so we might be able to make a little bit of a more fair judgment about the man. He is more than a terrorist, certainly, as he's described by the Israelis. There's an interesting description of him. I'm reading now from a book by Connor Cruz O'Brien called The Siege. Those who reminisce about Arafat often talk about those large, prominent eyes of his, which he could use to convey affection or menace, shifting at will from one expression to another with a somewhat hypnotic effect. As well as being an accomplished actor himself, he has shown a remarkable flair for the theatrical element in politics, for getting and holding the attention of an audience, not that his talent should be reduced to that. And this is the important part. To survive as long as he has done in the near desperate type of politics in which he has been engaged must take a great deal of cool intelligence as well as courage and extraordinary powers of resilience. The man certainly has that. People have buried him time and time again and have said, he's finished, it's all over, but he again rises. Still, his historic capacity is a particularly important part of his political repertoire. Under defeat after defeat, betrayal after betrayal, betrayal in turn by Jordan, by Syria and Lebanon, by Egypt and by Syria and Lebanon again, and then yet a third time, he has acted out his role in such a way as to hold the sympathy and admiration of a large audience and even to create the impression that in some ultimate sense, it is he who is winning. That's the sense I always get. Somehow he manages to rise like the proverbial phoenix from the ashes, and you kind of get the feeling that, well, he's on top again. He certainly did that after Beirut. I think the latest indication of that was the last Arab conference that happened in the fall, right in 87, right before the uprising began, when everyone said, oh, Arafat's finished, because the main agenda item at that meeting was the Iran-Iraq war, and the PLO and the Palestinian issue got pretty much put on the back burner. Some people say that was kind of the last straw, which was also one of the big one of the circumstances that led to the uprising, because the Palestinians again found themselves being ignored. And everybody said Arafat was dead. Well, of course, that didn't happen. From the beginning, Arafat was and continues to be an extremely pragmatic politician. You can see that by the way Fatah was put together, how it continued to exist. Fatah was a paramilitary group founded by Arafat and his associates, but it was marked from the beginning by shrewd, pragmatic political intelligence. Arafat knew, because of the tremendous split in the Arab world, because of the tremendous rivalries that had gone on, that he needed every bit of support from every area that he could get it. That meant he needed support from the conservatives in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. He needed the support from the religious people. He needed the support from more secular governments like Syria and like Egypt. And he had to play these people off against each other. And he did it extremely well. Fatah itself means in Arabic the opening, but it also has a specific Islamic connotation. This is interesting. It has come to mean an opening by conquest of a land for Islam. So here you see there is a bit of the idea of Islamic war, a holy task, etc., which would certainly appeal to an element. But at the same time, it the PLO, and certainly Fatah calls itself a secular democratic movement. So again, he's playing both sides off toward the middle. Fatah, having touched that Muslim note subliminally, left it at that. There were no Muslim fundamentalist appeals. Fatah wanted to close no important Arab doors. It wanted to attract the support of the secular modernizing Arab states, Egypt, Syria, as well as the Orthodox and oil-rich ones. Fatah was Muslim, but not too Muslim, which was about right for the region and for the time. It's really interesting to note that this necessity to be very pragmatic was at the same time, one could say, a source of the PLO's and Arafat's weakness. He was always doing a balancing act. He was always playing off one side off of the other, and he became a master at it. He played Syria off against Jordan, Egypt off everybody else, and because it was necessary to keep this coalition of organizations within the PLO together, every decision had to be made by consensus. He was always afraid of losing somebody, which then, of course, would blow the thing totally apart. And since the PLO was the only game in town, essentially, for Palestinian nationalism, it had to be kept together at all costs. So while all these years it may have looked as though Arafat was had no nerve, that he had no courage, in essence, he was playing a very practical political game. Sometimes he may have played that game a little too far, but anyway, he did manage to keep the movement together, which was very important during that period of time. Playing all these factions off against each other, trying to offend no one, sometimes made it difficult for the PLO, and I'm sure for Arafat himself, to respond to what I believe was the growing understanding in the West Bank, at least, among those Palestinians that were living day in and day out under Israeli occupation, that they had to moderate their views. No more this talk about secular democratic state. No more this talk about getting rid of Israel. I can remember speaking with the mayor of Bethlehem, who is not known as being a particularly strong PLO supporter, but still, he was very frustrated because he said, look, you know, I live here every day with the Israelis. I know what they're like. I know how powerful these people are. We talk, and then he said, we live here every day, and then we have to listen to these fools in Tunis or other places talking about the armed struggle. He said, the armed struggle, that's a joke. We can't fight the Israelis with weapons. We have to get some kind of unified political agenda so we can sit down and talk about a negotiated peace, because we cannot deal with the Israelis. We cannot fight them militarily. I'm sure that Arafat knew that, even though his rhetoric probably reflected something else. Again, his feeling that he had to be more hardline to keep the organization together. There's a very interesting story about a fellow named Abu Iyad, who now is very close to Arafat and the Fatah organization, but some years past had been more closely aligned with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which is led by a Christian named George Habash. This group is much more a Marxist kind of orientation, and Abu Iyad had originally been with that group and was with Habash in Beirut when the Israelis were raining bombs down on Beirut during the invasion, and a lot of us saw that on our television screens. This is kind of a lesson in how you get real. Habash had been very rejectionist in his views of Israel, that the Israelis would have to leave, or we would fight the Israelis, we would defeat them, et cetera, et cetera. And they're sitting in this bunker in Beirut, the bombs are falling down, and Abu Iyad looks at George Habash and says, see, they do exist. And he said in an article I recently read that was the point where he said, enough of this rejectionist stuff. we've got to deal with the Israelis. We can't fight them. And he then left Habash and joined Arafat. The main problem for Arafat and the PLO was, of course, as I said, this balancing act that sometimes seemed to paralyze the PLO and keep it from responding when it should have. And also the second problem was this leadership at a distance. You know, it's very hard to lead any kind of national liberation movement when you're not on the ground with the people. I've sometimes wondered what would happen in South Africa, for example, if people like Desmond Tutu and Alan Bosak and some of those people were in exile in Zambia or Mozambique or something like that. Arafat always had to lead from a distance, and that's a very difficult thing to do. Of course, he couldn't lead from the West Bank, because if he'd ever set foot in the West Bank, the Israelis would have arrested him right away. Again, as I said, the situation kind of came to a head with the conference, the Arab conference in the fall of 87, when the Palestinians and the PLO felt that their agenda was being put on the back burner. Then the uprising began in December of 87. And in a sense, that was a blessing for Arafat, but it was also a real threat. Because how was he going to contain this? Or how was he going to, in a sense, get it under control? The Palestinians in the West Bank were running ahead of him. And it was a great concern in PLO circles that, again, if this uprising simply took off, that there were factions within the West Bank that would blow everything apart. And again, it was very important to get this uprising under the umbrella of PLO authority and under the leadership of Arafat. In the beginning, I don't think Arafat probably knew what to do and how to assert control. But through it all, the PLO is still spoken of as the sole and legitimate representative of the Palestinians, and Arafat is still revered as the leader. What his future will be, it's very interesting to think about. I don't know. But anyway, he is still revered as the chairman, and the PLO is still the organization which holds which is recognized as the political leadership of the Palestinians. I realized when this was going on, beginning probably about a year ago, that there were problems within the leadership, certainly between the people in the West Bank leadership and between Arafat, who was usually in Tunis or some other place. But again, I want to tell you one story that I find, from a political point of view, so incredibly interesting and also so able to illustrate Arafat's incredible political abilities. There is probably what we would call him as the press secretary of the PLO was a man by the name of Bassam Abu Sharif. And about a year ago, Abu Sharif came out with this very moderate statement talking about, I mean, I'd never read anything like this before, talking about how both Israelis and Palestinians had suffered tragically as the result of this conflict, and that it was time to start talking and time to work on a diplomatic solution. I mean, he didn't at that point go so far as Arafat did later in recognizing Israel's right to exist, but everything was there. It was an incredible statement. About 2 days later, Abu Iyad, the fellow who had the bombs falling on his head in Beirut, and also now another close person to Arafat, came out in the newspapers and said, no, don't believe it. He kind of rejected the whole thing. And again, you know, you just kind of breathed this sigh and said, my goodness, when is the PLO going to get it together? One day they say one thing, the next day they say another thing, and the Israelis are always saying you can't trust what they say, why don't they speak with one voice, and here they're screwing up again. Only later did I realize what was really behind this. And again, it had to do with factions within the PLO, of Arafat trying to decide how far he could go. What I am convinced he did was very shrewd. He believed what Bassam Abu Sharif said. He believed in the moderate line, or he wanted to see how far this moderate line could go. So I'm sure he sat down with Abu Sharif. They put together this statement. They released it. Abu Iyad, probably representing a more rejectionist wing, or kind of rejected it. But Arafat wasn't interested in what the Israelis thought, or what the Americans thought, or what even perhaps some of the factions of the PLO thought. He was interested to know how this flew in the West Bank, because he realized that his power, base of power, had now moved. The base of power was no longer outside. The base of power was in the West Bank with those Palestinians who were day by day throwing stones at the Israelis. The word must have come back rather quickly from the West Bank to Arafat saying, yes, this is exactly what we want you to say, which then gave Arafat the power to turn to the rejectionists like Abu Iyad and say, hey, look, folks, I'm leading here, and I'm just doing what the Palestinians want me to do, what the people in the West Bank want me to do. So in a sense, when the power base shifted to the West Bank and the Palestinians there, it let Arafat off the hook, because it gave him the leeway to make the moderate statements that I think he'd wanted to make for some time but was kept from making. But he then had the power to say, look, as the leader of the PLO, I am reflecting the wishes and the feelings of the Palestinians on the ground in the West Bank. Then, of course, we have Arafat's statement in Geneva, when he finally got all of the right words in the right order. That was another crazy thing. You know, I've heard people who were at that meeting, and Arafat always has a problem. His English isn't really good, and he speaks with a pretty much of a heavy accent, and he knew exactly what he was supposed to say. The script was all there. It had come from Washington. And but he didn't. He maybe, you know, you get in front of people and they turn on big television lights and you kind of forget what you're supposed to do, and so he said it wrong. You know the story. He didn't say it exactly right the first time, and then the phone calls went back to the United States and they said, no, he's got to say it in a different way. Well, how do you want to say it? Well, okay, let's try it again. And then he calls a press conference for the next day, and there are stories of his lieutenants sitting in the front row mouthing the words, this is what you're supposed to say. And he did it, and he said it exactly the right way, and everybody was happy. What he said was, Israel has the right to exist, PLO accepts UN Resolution 242338, which calls for exchange of land for peace, and the third was renouncing the use of terror. That meeting, of course, was then followed up by a very interesting meeting that happened in Stockholm, Sweden, which was arranged by some, I think the U.S. ambassador, or the Swedish ambassador. Who?
Jewish ambassador.
The Jewish ambassador? No, I think it was a Swede. There were American Jews there, but it was a Swede who helped make everything come together. And the people who were at that meeting were American Jewish leaders who realized that, of course, what the Israelis had then said after Arafat said the words right was, well, this is nothing new, we can't believe him, he's just a terrorist, forget it. Some of the members of the American Jewish community felt that it was very important that some Jews start speaking with Arafat. So they, after a number of negotiations and whatever, met him in Stockholm. One of the members of that delegation is an American Jewish woman lawyer by the name of Rita Hauser. She works in the U.S. State Department, And about 3 months ago, I saw her at a meeting in Washington, D.C. And she's quite a woman. This woman is not ruled by her heart. She's ruled by her head. She has a real lawyer's mind. And she said at that meeting that she felt there was nothing in this conflict that could not be settled by some creative diplomacy. Also at that meeting was a man by the name of William Quant, who now is at the Brookings Institution in Washington. He was the man who negotiated the Camp David Accords for Jimmy Carter. And he again said, while the psychological problems are immense, the political problems are very simple, or rather simple. The Israelis need two things. The Israelis need to know that they're going to be secure. Considering the geography and considering their history, they have a right to have some very good guarantees for security. Number two, they need to have some understanding of the refugee problem, meaning that if there is some kind of Palestinian state, there are a lot of refugees in Jordan, in Lebanon, other places, and the Israelis want to make it clear that while those refugees can come back, they cannot come back to Israel, because again, that would the influx of that number of people would really put the Jewish majority in Israel in jeopardy. In terms of the PLO, what they need to know, and this was very interesting because it was articulated at this meeting by someone who's Jewish, by Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg, who has written the definitive book on Zionism and has taught at Columbia and at Dartmouth. And he stood up in front of this group of people and said, it's very simple. The Palestinians are like anybody else. When you go to the train station to get on the train, you don't get on the train before you know, or until you know, where the train is going. You don't just get on for the ride and hope that the train is going to end up in Chicago or New York. If you want to go to Chicago, you want to know the train is going to eventually end up in Chicago. And that's the basic point for the Palestinians. They want to have some guarantee before they enter into negotiations that eventually, they will have some kind of state self-determination, whatever. They are not going to enter into negotiations which will only give them limited rule, and they're afraid that that is exactly what the Israelis want to do, that the Israelis are not at all serious about self-determination. The Israelis want to continually keep the situation more or less as it is, give the Palestinians some freedom, but certainly not the amount of self-determination or freedom that they want. I'm going to go on now and talk about where each side is kind of at present. Are there any questions up to this point? Or any comments?
One comment about Arafat's balancing problems. Another whole system of balancing that he's had to do from the outset is with, of course, all the other Arab states. And this has been almost as difficult as keeping the umbrella over the whole PLO, because many of the factions within the PLO are supported by different Arab states at different times. Right now he's on the outs very badly with Hafez al-Assad in Syria, in part because Syria backs a dissident faction, which continually has done. And the relevance of this is that one of the ironies of history is that the PLO was set up in order for Nasser to control Palestinians. Because there were groups that were forming that were outside of his control, he wanted an umbrella organization which he could be able to dominate in order to make sure that Palestinians didn't do anything different than Nasser, who was the most dominant figure in the Middle East at that time, was able to do. The irony, of course, is that it created an organization which none of the surrounding states wanted to see, which was an autonomous voice for the Palestinians. All of them preferred to use the Palestinians as a tool with which they could play diplomacy, and that was the original purpose of setting it up. It was only after the 67 war when Nashville was discredited that it was able to change into that kind of unbalanced. Right.
So Paul is absolutely right. I mean, not only did Arafat have he had to balance different Arab leaders off of each other for his own good, realizing that at the bottom of it all these people wanted to do, whether it was Hussein or whether it was Nasser or whether it was Assad, is they wanted to control the Palestinians. I mean, they wanted to take his authority away from him. So, you know, what the man, again, I don't mean to make a hero out of him, but what he has managed to do in terms of this incredible balancing act, when on the surface, when Conor Cruz O'Brien says he was betrayed again and again and again, he certainly was. You know, in the newspapers you'd see Arafat going to Jordan and he would be embracing King Hussein, and then Hussein would do something, and then they were on the outs, and you think, well, he'd never go to Amman again, and you know, a year later there he is embracing. I mean, Arafat has kissed and embraced everybody in the Middle East. In fact, I even saw today a picture of him, I don't know where, embracing Khomeini. So, but, you know, you have to say something about the single-minded dedication of the man. But again, you know, it's been bloody. It's been bloody. But what national liberation movement has not been bloody? Any other questions?
But because he has made such a transition in order to keep all these plates in the air and spinning all at the same time and making everybody happy, at this point, as it appears to be entering into serious negotiation, mm-hmm. would it not make sense that he may have to step aside for the legitimacy of the negotiation to take place with someone that hasn't
right.
moved the full spectrum
right.
of where they want to end up.
Right. I've thought of that a lot. I mean, there are certain leaders in history who have too much bloody baggage. I mean, considering, but then you have to look at it at the other way as well. It's interesting to contrast the Israeli view of Sadat and the Israeli view of Arafat. If you look at the situation with very clear eyes, Sadat, because of the Yom Kippur War and the rest, was certainly responsible for far more Israeli deaths than ever Arafat, many, 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 many times over. But, you know, yet when Sadat came to Jerusalem, he was an overnight hero. I don't think that Arafat could ever do that. I've talked to a number of Israelis about that, and they say, no, it's the kind of activity. Arafat and the PLO has always been a ghost. Israel has always been much more afraid of fighting ghosts than it has fighting other armies. One of the Israeli military people said, look, you know, Sadat had an army. We knew that. We knew where the army was. We knew if we had to go to war with them, well, okay, we'd send in the tanks, and there they were, and there we were, and we knew the rules. But the kind of war that Arafat has been fighting, this kind of guerrilla terror thing, is much more frightening and has had a much more profound effect on the collective psyche of Israelis. And I would find it certainly difficult to think that if the time ever comes for the individuals involved to sit down and start talking about peace, I have a real hard time seeing Arafat's face around that table. One of the other people that I talked to some years ago was a man by the name of Hanna Nasser, who was the president of Birzeit University. And when I met him, he had been exiled, deported to Amman. And I asked him that same question about Arafat, if he would show up at the negotiating table. And he kind of laughed and said, well, you know, you just don't get rid of your leaders because they don't shave. But he recognized that as well. And it's kind of interesting to contemplate, but also the thing that I've learned lately, ever since certainly Arafat's statement and then the U.S. State Department's decision to start talking with with the PLO, And this has been basically because of a lot of meetings that have now begun to take place. It's interesting to see that the kind of private agenda is running much ahead of the kind of official diplomatic agenda. Israelis and Palestinians are meeting left and right all over the world. After this meeting in Washington, there was a big meeting in New York where members of the Knesset, certainly left-wing members of the Israeli parliament, came and met with officials of the PLO. Now, a few years ago, that would never have happened. I mean, there is a law in the book saying that if you're a member of the Knesset and you meet, well, I think if you're a, what is it, Paul, is it, if you're a member, if you're an Israeli at all and meet with somebody with the PLO, you can be arrested, can't you?
Yeah.
But nobody's enforcing that law anymore. So the private agenda, you just had a feeling that these people wanted to talk to each other. And in another sense, the PLO, from the writings of the people who you now hear, there are many more people in addition to Arafat, like Bassam Abu Sharif, who did another incredible thing. He made a videotape of himself and sent it off to a meeting of the International the International Committee for Peace in the Middle East in their office in Tel Aviv. He wanted to talk with the Israelis so badly that he made a videotape of himself, managed to get it into Israel, and they played it at this meeting. And what you see are really extremely articulate and extremely bright people in the PLO. Nabil Shaath, I don't think I've ever seen anyone more reasonable and more brilliant than this man is. So there are plenty of Palestinians within the PLO who could certainly sit and react diplomatically with the Israelis. In fact, probably really challenge the Israelis. These people are not fools. They're very intelligent. One thing that William Quant said at this meeting after having been with Arafat, he said it's very interesting to see the difference between Arafat and Sadat. Sadat, of course, everybody loved him. He wore wonderful clothes. he was very charming. But Sadat kind of had the feeling that the Americans were going to make peace for him. He said when we negotiated at Camp David, Sadat would just kind of come in and he would say, well, he kind of generally wanted this and this and this, and then he would leave and say, okay, do it to the Americans. And Quant says now that the Palestinians are much different than that. They don't want to talk to the Americans. They want to talk directly to the Israelis, and they don't want anybody to make peace for them. They want to sit and deal with the Israelis themselves. They have a very different kind of hands-on feeling of wanting to negotiate for themselves and work for themselves. Okay, where is everybody these days? The Palestinians seem to be waiting. They seem to feel that time is on their side. They are certainly not going to stop the Intifada because it's the only thing that's ever gotten them anything or anywhere. And when it's their only card, they're not about to take it off the table. They're also kind of, I don't know how to explain this, I think it's an overstatement to say that they're drunk with victory. But you have to sit with them, you have to see their spirit, you have to have conversations with them. I tell you, some of these people are acting like the whole thing's already over. Jonathan Kutab, who's Daoud Kutab's brother, he's the person I quoted at the beginning tonight. Jonathan Kutab is a lawyer, an extremely articulate young man. Again, a person who could, you see some of these people and you just say, these are the leaders, these could be the leaders of these, they are the leaders, but what they could do, if they were kind of officially elected leaders. Jonathan Kutab says it's over. It's over. The state will be. It will happen. And again, it was interesting to hear what Arthur Herzberg said at this speech in Washington. He said the same thing. He said, ladies and gentlemen, the Palestinian state will be. It's going to happen.
Where does a Palestinian state be at?
The West Bank and Gaza.
So is that right in the middle of Israel territory?
Oh, I'm sorry, I don't have my map. I should have had the map.
It's occupied territory.
I'm sorry, I don't have the map. But it's and we're not saying that it's going to be exactly those borders, because there's going to be a lot of negotiations that will have to happen to set the borders, et cetera, et cetera. But basically, that's what we're talking about. I'm a little worried about this kind of attitude, because it tends to be a flight from reality. And now is not the time for either Israelis or Palestinians to run away from reality. Now is the time when they have to be the toughest and the most clear-sighted that they've ever been in their lives, because what they need to do now is stop dealing with myths and start dealing with putting together a kind of political agenda where both sides can deal with each other in a diplomatic manner. I had seen, I went to Gaza and had noticed something that was kind of frightening. Before, when I traveled in the West Bank, I'd noticed that the young people, you see mostly boys, not necessarily girls, but boys of the age of like 8 or 9, 10, maybe 12, 13, teenagers too. The Palestinian kids, when I'd seen them before, had been really rather shy. You know, if you were an American or if you were a foreigner or whatever, they would kind of stand back and they'd be a little shy and they wouldn't say anything and they'd kind of stand there and if you say hello, they'd kind of, you know, they were nice kids who lived under a very authoritarian type of educational system. They knew how to take orders very well from their superiors. This time I went to Ali Arab Hospital to see some of the people who had been shot the day before. And there were, out in the courtyard there, kids, Palestinian kids, waiting to go and visit these people. Some of them, I suppose, their relatives or their friends who'd been shot. And I tell you, those kids scared me. They had looks in their eyes that said, we don't care who you are, we have been through what you can't even believe would happen in the last year. We've probably been beaten, we might have been shot ourselves. We're not taking anything from anybody. We're in charge here now. I mean, it was right in their eyes. I couldn't believe it. It was very, very frightening. And this kind of sense of power to a 13-year-old or a 12 or 13 or 14-year-old can be very, very dangerous, because I said, these kids are the people who are in charge of Gaza. People don't understand this. I tell this to my Israeli friends, and they can't believe it. And I say to them, okay, go to Gaza. Don't listen to what I say. Go there. You'll see these people. You'll understand. They are in control. And I said to some of the professors in the universities, Palestinians, how in the world are you going to control these kids? How are you going to mold this just anger and whatever is in these kids into any kind of mature political agenda? It's very frightening. I'm hopeful, but it's somewhat frightening. The United States right now, I think, is probably closer to the Palestinian position than the Israeli position. I have a feeling that there's a lot of talk going on between the Palestinian leadership and the Americans. I think they're waiting for Israel, and I don't know if they're waiting in vain. Literally, the Americans forced upon Shamir, when he came to Washington lately, he was told before he got there that he had better come up with some kind of new idea, that he couldn't simply say, well, there's nothing new. And that's basically what the official Israeli government response has been to everything that's happened in the last year. Well, this is nothing new. And of course, what he came up with was the idea for elections. I mean, Shamir is not foolish. He knew that the idea of elections sounds great. That's democratic. Americans like the idea of elections. So let's have elections. But unfortunately, the Israelis right now, certainly the Israeli government, they're not thinking any further than 2 feet in front of them. Everything that's happening now, I think, in terms of reactions to this conflict, is they're not looking down the road. They're just thinking, how can we diffuse the pressure on us by the Israelis, by the Americans, by everybody else? Certainly, the speech that James Baker gave to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is the most powerful pro-Israel lobbying group in the United States. You know, 2 years ago, you would never have believed that such a speech could be made. Baker simply went to the convention of AIPAC and said straight out, Israel has to give up the dream of greater Israel, meaning it has to be willing to make territorial concessions. It has to see the situation realistically. It has to give up the ideas of annexation. Now, Baker could have given that speech in any number of places. I mean, he could have, at some, you know, university graduation, he could have given that speech. But the fact that he went to AIPAC and he gave the speech there means, I hope, that the United States government means business. He tried to be very even-handed. If you read the speech, he tells the Palestinians that they have got to be forthcoming as well. They have got to speak with one voice. But, of course, it came mostly as a shock to Israel, because Israel had never been spoken to in that straight a manner before by a Secretary of State. The United States also, I think, believes that they have time on their side, that there is time. One thing is for sure, the United States is not about to lose face again in the Middle East in terms of diplomatic initiatives. They have learned the hard way from Lebanon, and they've learned the hard way from a number of peace proposals that they have floated, which have then blown up in their faces and made them look pretty foolish, that they are not going to insert themselves. They're not going to take the lead. They want to do everything they can to bring these two sides together, to kind of oil the skids, but they're not going to get themselves in the middle of something that could end in a diplomatic disaster. I think they're thinking, look, if the Israelis and Palestinians really want peace, then let them do it. We'll do as much as we can. We'll make it as easy for them as possible. But they're the ones who need the peace. If they really want it, they'll make the concessions that have to be made so that we can get on with it. I think the United States wants Israel to talk with the Palestinians directly. I don't think the United States wants to talk for Israel. But, of course, Israel won't talk to the PLO. And that's a real difficulty right now, to try to get over that. I was at this television show, the Nightline show, about a year ago, more than a year ago now, that was broadcast from Israel, and happened to be in Israel that time, and got a friend had some extra passes, and so I sat there and watched the whole thing happen. And of course, as you remember, if you saw that, there was a panel of Palestinians and a panel of Israelis, some kind of right-wingers and some young, good Labor Party people. And one of the Likud people was a member of Knesset by the name of Ehud Olmert, young guy, not very old. And he was making a very strong statement and said, I don't want to talk to the PLO. I want to talk to the Palestinians. And, of course, the audience was made up of Palestinians and Israelis. And everybody laughed. I mean, it was like a joke. That this person who's supposed to have a member of the Knesset says he doesn't want to talk to the PLO, he wants to talk to the Palestinians, and the Palestinians just roared and said, the fool, doesn't he know? I mean, you know, the Palestinians and the PLO are inseparable. You can't separate the two. I think the United States is willing, and whether this is smart or not, I'm not sure, certainly Rita Hauser and William Quant think that time is of the essence, that now is the time to move. I think the U.S. is willing to let the situation, it's like a pot of stew, it's on the fire, let it cook a little bit, let things get so difficult, and I think they're thinking especially for the Israelis. Let the Israelis feel the heat a little more, so that will push them toward making the concessions that they'll have to make, so that they will be willing to sit down and talk to the PLO. The United States knows that it's no use to threaten Israel, it's no use to do those kinds of things because Israel just pulls in on itself. So I think what the U.S. is thinking is let the situation get tougher for them so that they'll make the concessions that they have to make. The Israelis are really in a big mess. They've got a government now because of the split in the last election between the left and the right that is really almost incapable of making any political decisions. I mean, right now when some important decisions need to be made, the government's incapable of making them because of this left-right split. It's interesting, they call it a government of national unity when in effect nothing could be further from the truth. It's a government of national disunity. As far as I can see, the biggest problem is simply that Shamir, whether he believes it or not, and I think he probably does believe it because it's good Orthodox Zionist revisionist ideology, that he can't give up an inch of the West Bank. This territory is not negotiable. It's Israel's. It was given to Israel by God. There is no compromise. He needs to say that for political purposes, because if he said anything else, the right-wingers, the religious nationalists who make up part of his coalition would desert him and the government would fall. Again, whether he means that or not, you know, how much he says this out of political expediency, I don't know. But I think he probably does mean it. It's probably an ideology that he holds very close to his heart. And, of course, then the Palestinians turn around and say, look, you know, the prime minister of the state of Israel says there is going to be no trading of territory for peace. There's going to be no withdrawal. So how can you negotiate with this? This is impossible. And in a sense, you know, one should challenge Shamir on the recognition of UN Resolution 242, which says right there that peace is going to be obtained by the return of some territories. It doesn't say all the territories. It says some territories. But that means that Shamir has to be willing to make some kind of compromise on that issue. And again, he says, absolutely not. And so the Palestinians throw up their hands and say, it's a non-starter. We're not going to get involved in this. Why should we get involved in this? There's nothing in this for us. I think the idea, as I said before, of elections is only buying time. The Israelis are trying to buy time to figure out what to do next. They're also trying to please the Americans who are putting pressure on them. They won't give up the West Bank. And, you know, if there were elections, the people elected would be, say straight out that they're representatives of the PLO, and the Israelis have said they won't talk to the PLO. So what is this business about elections? Again, it's a problem. What should happen? Well, in the best case scenario, there would be elections. Somehow there would be a situation worked out where Israel would say, okay, we'll go ahead with the elections, we'll draw back our troops, we'll put in an international force so that the Palestinians will be free to have a free and open election. Number two, we'll have guarantees before the elections even happen that those people elected, who of course after the elections will say they're PLO, will not then just turn around and be deported by the Israelis. We'll have to know that the people we elect will in fact be the ones who will be in the West Bank and will be able to negotiate for us. after the elections, one would hope that there would be a Palestinian delegation and an Israeli delegation that would come together somewhere in the world, maybe in Geneva, and start talking about the real hard issues. Set up a framework, a time frame for not only the negotiations, but for the settlement. We're not talking about the Palestinians having a state tomorrow. There's too much bad blood, there's too much fright, certainly fright on the part of the Israelis. Yeah, Chuck.
I'm waving to my wife.
Oh, sorry. Okay. There has to be time to get things together. I mean, the Palestinians don't have any they don't have any institutions on the ground. They need time to get themselves together so that there isn't a dangerous kind of political vacuum that can be taken advantage of by unscrupulous people. So the Palestinians need time, and they know they need time as well. They're very realistic on this issue. Let's say that, you know, that there's decision that certain things will happen in 2 years and then more freedom will be given in 3 and 4 and 5 and whatever, so that during this time when the Palestinians take over responsibility for their own governing, et cetera, it will also be a time for the Israelis to build confidence so that in 10 years, whatever, when there is a Palestinian state or what you might want to call it, the Israelis will say, okay, we've had 10 years to live with the Palestinians as they have step by step taken more responsibility for their own lives. We realize we can trust them. It's going to be demilitarized, et cetera, et cetera. So they need time. But what they need to do is start the negotiations to set up that framework, timelines, confederation agreements with Jordan, whatever. And then after that, then there should be the International Peace Conference. The Israelis are always afraid of going to this International Peace Conference in Geneva and having the world do a trick on them or having them outflanked or whatever. The International Peace Conference doesn't happen first. The International Peace Conference happens last when all of the important decisions have been made. When Sadat went to Jerusalem, he went there knowing exactly what he was going to get. And that's what the Israelis need. They need to know exactly what they're going to get. Well, I guess we better stop. We almost made it. I'm sorry there haven't been a time to take any more of your questions. I'll be around, and I'll certainly be willing and happy to talk with you about this and answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you.